it picks up that. Okay, now I think we're okay, so we'll proceed on.
Okay, testing again, 1, 2, 3.
Right, now we're good, all right. Okay, finally, I'm sorry for all the difficulties with the tape recorder. Sperry ran work 1958-61. You talked about the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology Project, and like you said, that's written up to some extent.
Yes.
In your work and in
the other thing that started about that time was talk with Medlars. I had been active off and on with Astia during my stay at Remington Rand, and several times they asked me to come work with them, and I told them that I didn't want to, that I didn't know enough about military stuff, and I was a peacenik, and I wasn't very interested in DOD material. But after I got home one day, I thought, well, their problem's not that different from the Merck Sharp and Dohme problem. They have a lot of similarities, and I could go tell them about how they could do all this on a computer, and then let them work it out. And so I did. I went down. I mean, they were very receptive, and I said, I'll come. And they brought all the brass in to listen to what I had to say, acted enthusiastic, and said, okay, come do it for us. And I said, no, I can't do that. I have too much else on the fire.
You went and talked with them as an individual consultant or
as an individual consultant. Well, as a
Sperry Rand employee?
Sperry Rand employee, yeah.
Okay, as one of the projects that they would fund Sperry Rand to do. Okay.
Right, uh-huh. And so again, it went into limbo for a little while, but then when the story got around Sperry Rand, they decided they would go ahead and write the program at Sperry Rand and put it out with the idea that they could sell it with their machines, the program. And so they had my helper, Clayton Shepherd, write the program the way I specified it, and they never succeeded in selling any machines with the program intact. I don't know why. So there was a meeting, there was a demonstration at Astia of what this wonderful computer that they had just bought from Sperry Rand would do for them, and it was just some very piddling kind of use of the machine. It didn't at all use the capacity or solve the problem that they really should have been solving. And so at the meeting, me being badly behaved as usual, I got up from the floor and made a presentation of what they could have done, that this is a starting point. I tried to be polite, but so this was just a starting point, and they were able to go on and do much more sophisticated things, and then I described what they could do. And I got a lot of attention, but one of the things that happened on the way out, Brad Rogers, whom I'd met for the first time at the beginning of that meeting, and he was the director of the National Library of Medicine, he had just given me a perfunctory greeting at the time I was introduced, but when the meeting was over, he ran behind me and caught up with me and put his arm around me and said, could you make it do that? Could you make a computer do that for the National Library of Medicine? And I said, yes. He didn't say, could I do it? He said, could we do it at the National Library of Medicine? And I said, yes. And that was about the end of that conversation. And later on, very soon afterward, he called me down to the Library of Medicine for a day of consultation so we could talk about it some more. And he got more enthusiastic. And the next time I went down, my boss went along with me. My boss was not an information retrieval person. He was a mathematician. And they talked a little bit, and he and my boss couldn't communicate very well because their interests were so different. So he finally turned around to me, and he pounded on his desk, and he said, damn it, don't tell me yes you can do it, tell me how you can do it. And so he made a deal with my boss that I would go consult for the library for a number of times and tell them how they could do it. And he continued to get more and more interested, and eventually, soon after, let the contract for getting the work done.
It's Sperry Rand.
Letting... He asked for a contract proposals to do that kind of work with a computer. And, you know, being government, he had to circulate it to every, put it in the, whatever the newspaper was called. What's it called? Do you know that?
Either Federal Register or else the,
Federal something or other.
Yeah.
But that newspaper that they publish that tells all the grants that are available or contracts that, for which they're looking. And, of course, Sperry ran via me a bid on it. And I lost the bid to the General Electric Company.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is how I came to leave Sperry Rand, because I didn't have any other ongoing work that couldn't either be taken with me or left undone. And I just announced that I was going to leave. And then I spoke to the National Library of Medicine about the fact that I was now unemployed, and I'd gone with Dr. Richard Orr to start the institute. He had started the Institute for Advancement of Medical Communication. And so I just told him I was going to be there from there on, and if they ever... Stop being so gone.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay, I believe we've got it working, Mrs. Schultz. If you want to come back, I think it's going fine now.
Whatever.
All right. I believe it's going now. When you went to work, did Moshley talk to you about specific projects or just a sort of whatever you want to do kind of job? I don't have a good understanding of what...
I think he trusted my judgment as to what would be worthwhile projects. But we did have people coming in from the outside all the time making requests for work that would help them in what they needed to do. And so we did, John O'Connor and I sometimes visited various places and learned about their problems and would come back and see whether we could help them in any way. But we never found anything we wanted to sink our teeth into.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that Dr. Mockley talked with me about was the post office, what they call the post office problem of trying to get mail sorted the way that it's done now.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know. Then, and the fingerprint department was always after us to figure out a way to identify fingerprints very quickly. But I didn't have any solutions to that. That wasn't my bag to think of, you know, solutions to problems like that. So, so to answer your question, Mockley did talk with us about problems and needed solving. He was interested in the traveling salesman problem, which eventually got whipped. It was a problem of salesmen has to go all around the United States on various occasions, and he wanted to do it by the shortest possible route and touch all these bases. And they wanted a way to solve that with a mathematical formula of some kind. And he worked on that a lot himself and would talk to the rest of us about it to see if we had any ideas. But again, he flunked out with me because that wasn't my bag either.
So now you said there were 40 or four so folks
all working on different projects. And one of one group helped to solve the X-ray problem, which was then immediately used at the University of Pennsylvania to read X-rays by much more automated means than they ever had before. So one group did that. There were other groups who were specializing in just linear programming, and that was sort of Greek to me. I didn't know for sure what that meant, but it turned out later that one of them did work with me on something or other that we solved by linear programming. And but we had wonderful discussions together. Everybody was working on different things, and yet we'd trade information from time to time.
Oh, yeah.
We'd be down working on the computer at the same time. We used to fight for computer time because none of us could get as much time as we needed, especially if the computer would go down while we were trying to do our own problem. Then we'd have to wait 3 days to get on again or something. So I made it a habit to stay all night, one night a week, and nobody else, very few people, wanted to stay at night, so I could usually get on if I said I wanted at night. And I just work all night and come home in the morning. And my bibliography will tell you the papers that I produced during that period.
Yeah, I've read a number of them. Were you dependent upon contracts during this time?
Yeah, we were fully supported with Air Force contract money and Office of Naval Research money. The various, I don't know why, military was funding the computer to the extent that it was, but they did. And they sort of let us choose what projects we wanted to do.
Based on all the ones that were floating around. And you did, I noticed you did the paper on comparing the Merck Sharp and Dohme file with the Astia file. And that was, I believe, dealing with vocabulary control, or that was... What is the... Was that project the beginning of your interest in vocabulary control, or had it gone back even further?
Oh, it had gone back to the very beginning at Merck.
With the counting of the terms that you were using in the...
Oh, I see. I had never studied that formally until I got to Sperry Rand. And that was one of my first projects because I wanted a project that I thought would be useful to other people and yet would help to teach me how to use the computer. And then I chose that.
But it was related to your interest in vocabulary control and thesaurus building and those kinds of things. Talk about that issue, because that seems to be a sort of constant theme of your interest, was vocabulary control.
I guess it was. I'm not quite sure why that was central, but maybe I do know why. It was because no indexing and retrieval work could be done at that time without very careful wording and selection of terminology for searches, because if you picked the wrong term, you didn't get the answer that you wanted. It was it was very central to being successful in doing retrieval work. And the rest of the story is that the standard classification systems, which had vocabularies, indexes at the back with vocabulary words, didn't satisfy a great many of the conditions, because they were met as words that would modify other words like Civil War, history, and then 1812 or something. And everything was arranged that way, and that didn't satisfy all the searching conditions that you might want to specify, because you might be interested in history, but not Civil War history, or not 1812 history. And you just want to use history and then combine it with something quite different mm-hmm. in order to solve your problem. Well, I wanted language that came without being strung out like that into divisions and subdivisions. I wanted all the words to function separately. That was Moore's idea. It wasn't mm-hmm. my idea.
Right.
But I kept working on that in all the projects I did. And at Astia, I helped to develop the vocabulary for Astia after Taub's reign at Astia was over, and they were convinced that they did need to use the cards with the subjects all on one card rather than document numbers on a whole lot of cards. They decided to make a vocabulary like that, and I was put in charge of doing the biological words. I mean, they had an awful lot of terminology, mm-hmm. military terminology, mm-hmm. and so they picked individuals to be in charge of particular things. And Gene Wall, who was at Taub's outfit, was chosen as the overall supervisor of that. And he and I had always been sort of at swords points about things. I wasn't sure it was going to work out to be working under him. But he gave me complete autonomy on that. And he liked what I did in the end. He got other people to do theirs more like I had done mine. Mm-hmm. And we got an overall Astia dictionary worked out in about 6 months or something like that. And then we ran tests on that to see how well it was functioning when mm-hmm. it came mm-hmm. to retrieval. Yeah, I agree that just about everything I did centered on vocabulary work, which, as I said earlier, probably wouldn't happen now because Pete Loon's ideas, which I didn't think were very feasible then. I mean, I thought they were smart, and I thought it was a clever way to use machines and all that, but I didn't think it solved the retrieval problem, because a quick index, you had to read every entry in the whole index to be sure you didn't miss something you wanted, because you could never predict what words the authors were using mm-hmm. to express what you wanted. So I thought controlled vocabulary was important for that reason, and automatic abstracting. I didn't give a dime for the first abstracts that they called automated abstracts.
Telegraphic abstracts plus the auto abstracts.
But the auto abstracts were just no good hardly at all yeah. in the beginning, but they gradually learned how to mm-hmm. make the technique work better because mm-hmm. they started screening out certain words and not allowing them to be considered and checking for pairing and triples and that kind of thing that together had much more precise meaning than any one of the terms used alone, and that kind of thing, and they got better at abstracting. But that was a form of vocabulary control too, and I don't know where it lies now. I haven't read automated abstracts in ages, and I don't know how good or how bad they are.
Yeah, I don't know much about that area, but vocabulary control is still definitely an issue.
It's still being used.
Yeah, folks are still building thesauri.
Yeah. And I think they're getting more or less passe, but I'm not sure about that. But I know that the structured indexes of the classification sort are not being used anymore.
Right, right. You must have seen the Cranfield studies when they first came out.
Yeah.
How did you feel that affected the kinds of orientation that you had?
I was very interested in him, and in general agreed with Cleverden and all that he was doing. You think that they were not...
I'm interested in your reaction. Uh-huh. I think they were really good studies.
Yeah, I think they were too.
They seem to give support for your approach toward the importance of vocabulary control.
Yeah, I thought we saw eye to eye on practically everything. I went to the conferences in England.
Did you?
And enjoyed them very much. And I found it quite intellectually stimulating.
How did the Cranfield studies generally hit folks here in the States? Was there a good deal of interest in them when they first came out?
Not as much as one would hope, but yeah, I mean, they got positive reactions. There were lots of jokes about the clever Don and all that kind of thing. They thought he'd been clever about getting money and that sort of thing. I didn't hear any, you know, really derogatory things about Cleverdon's work, I don't think. Hmm. It just didn't get sink in as fast as one might think it would.
But yeah. His getting NSF money must have rankled some feathers over here, ruffled some feathers.
It did, a little. Because they kept saying, what's special about him?
Yeah. Speaking of NSF, and particularly while you were at Sperry Rand, you all were supported mostly by, I think you said, military money.
Mm-hmm.
Did you try to get any NSF grants?
Oh yeah,
during this time?
And I had some during that period because NSF funded the ACES meeting during the year that I was vice chairman and therefore program chairman.
Uh-huh.
And they were very pleased with that, and that led to the annual review of information science.
Right.
And so they were pleased with the results of that. And what else? I did other things for NSF, but one time I went into Checkland. Maybe I shouldn't put this story on the record, but somebody ought to. I went into Checkland an appointment I had to see Bert Atkinson about my grant proposal, because it was right after I'd gone to with Dick Orr IAMC, Institute for the Advancement of Medical Communication.
Right, right.
And I wanted to see how it was coming along, because I had a grant from Harold Worcester, which he said he'd renew for me. And you know, Dick Orr didn't have much money. He was just an independent.
Now, Harold Worcester is?
It was Air Force.
Air Force. Sorry.
Air Force. And Worcester, by telephone, had told me a couple of times he'd support me, that I just had to make this and that and the other maneuver in order to arrange it. So I was still waiting for money from Worcester, and I applied for some from National Science Foundation. And I was in Washington and was in the area, so I dropped in unexpected at NSF. And said, was Dr. Atkinson available to talk to me about my request? And the secretary said, didn't you get the message? You had a telephone message over at ADOC asking you to have dinner with Dr. Atkinson. And I said, oh dear, I can't do that. I'm having dinner with Pete Lew, and it was just before he died. It wasn't. He didn't die at 64, this must have been 61. But I know I was having dinner with Pete Lew, and I wasn't going to change it to have dinner with Bert, because I didn't know Bert very well. And the secretary explained to me that unless I was willing to go to dinner with Dr. Atkinson and all that connoted, I wasn't going to get a grant. And I said, okay. And I walked out. So that explains why I didn't have anything from NSF, maybe.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you didn't know him at all?
I didn't know him well. I'd met him at meetings and heard him speak, and I knew who he was, and he was a great presence wherever he went, but I wasn't in the market.
Now, Madeline Henderson was also working in that office
with Helen Brownson. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now, she was the arms and legs, and I mean, Helen Brownson was a great person, but Madeline has always managed to do all the work wherever she goes, whether it's with Perry or with Helen Brownson or whoever. She does the work.
I have that suspicion, but I want to, is that really right?
She'll tell you that if you ask her.
Uh-huh.
She told me that, and so she, excuse me, did all the almost all the legwork at any rate, to go around and see the places that were being covered in the National Science Foundation, the two publications, the research and the random, what was it, the code application. I have them upstairs. I've forgotten the names of them, but she was writing the descriptions.
Oh, good, non-conventional.
Non-conventional, right, that's what I'm trying to say. And she was writing those descriptions, or at least the person in charge of the application would write a description of it, and then she'd visit and then revise it and make everything hang together for the booklet. So she was getting around and seeing everything that was going on and knowing everybody who was doing anything and was able to compare each of those things with one another. She was, as far as I'm concerned, the most knowledgeable person around at the time. She was great.
I gather that, I mean, it's just an amazing career that she's had in terms of the places she's worked and the projects she's
worked on. And the children she's had and the husbands she's had to put up with.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He's an alcoholic, and it makes her all kinds of problems.
Because she has several children on the way, too.
Yeah, her ambition was to have as many as I did. She said, I started later, but I'm going to have five. And I think she did. She has five.
Yeah. Who are these folks? Clayton Shepherd, you mentioned, I believe.
Yeah. He was a fellow who just came from Penn one day. He showed up, but I don't quite know how he came to be hired by Dr. Mockley, but he was assigned to me, and he was from the School of Urban Studies, and no background at all in computers or science or librarianship or anything that was related, and I thought, gee, thanks a lot, and they gave me this young man who I didn't know how I was going to relate to him. And it turned out pretty well because he really did want to learn. He was very interested in applying himself to the problem. So I would talk to him and he'd take notes and he would go back and write up a little program that did whatever I said. I mean, he didn't know how to program either.
Oh, is that right?
And he had to learn to do that. So he certainly worked hard. And I thought he was awfully limited when he first started, but I gradually got to be more impressed with him, and then I was rooting for him to go on and do better, bigger and better things. So I let him start writing papers about the programs that he had helped me to develop, so he'd be in print and be an author too. Mm-hmm. Then he went on from there and went to Marjorie Hislop at the Nettles place.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. For a little while. And then he went to the University of Indiana as a teacher when he got through with all that. So he had a pretty good career, but he died very early. He always told me he had a strong death wish, and I wondered, how does anybody know they have a strong death wish, and why would they have it?
But, interesting. Speaking of Marjorie Hislop, before I forget, because I've been seeing her name a lot, did you know her well?
I knew her professionally well, yeah, not personally well.
Should she be on the pioneers list, in your view?
I don't guess so. My impression of her, and this may be unfair to her, I don't know, is that she was not technically well qualified for what she did, but yet she worked hard, stuck to it, and so on, and was always there, and doing what needed to be done, but that she had no great inspiration.
Now, was she a librarian? Is that what she was?
I don't know how she got started. But yes, I think she was called the librarian for the Nettles group.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, so you, and the other was Phyllis Schwartz, I believe, and then Leon Steinberg, they did papers with you, I noticed.
The little Schwartz girl was just there to put in the time. She wasn't particularly interested in any of it. She disappeared quite soon afterward and had her family and so on. And I've never heard about her since. But Leon Schwartz was a mathematician who was intrigued by what I was doing but didn't quite know why I was doing it or what I was doing. And he would just sort of kibitz once in a while. And he wanted to be an author in that paper, so he was.
The paper you did that you titled "The Generalized Computer Method for Information Retrieval."
Yeah, did I get
it? What were you trying to do in that paper?
I guess I was just an egotistical on an egotistical trip of some kind, because Mary Elizabeth Stevens took me to task for it very much. She said, "Claire, the idea of calling that a generalized program. And I said, well, it's more general than anybody else has done, and it may not be the ultimate. And she said, it certainly can't be the ultimate, and you shouldn't have called it that. But anyhow, it was my attempt to say, you know, that this will work in more situations than one particular one. You can adapt it to additional situations. And that's all I meant by it.
It struck me as, one, it was intended for the novice to some extent, and secondly, that you were trying to lay it all out generally and make it less mysterious.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it struck me, but I'm reading it from a different perspective than you wrote.
Well, I think maybe you've hit it on the head, that's what I was after. But it's an ego piece. I'm sorry.
Well, you've relayed. That didn't strike me at all. And then you did the short thing in Wilson Library Bulletin, and another one, I believe, in Special Libraries that were sort of do-it-yourself kinds of automation.
Yeah, I was trying to entice other people to get their feet wet.
Well, I thought the three of them together were rather interesting. Not together, but I mean as separate pieces and different audiences were rather nice.
Well, thank you. I was trying. I think... I